show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, introducing the show as usual. I'm also the founder of the UK charity of the same name, Yes to Life, that for well over 15 years has been supporting people with cancer in discovering the many benefits of taking a broad integrative approach to treatment that addresses their many needs in body, mind and spirit. The Yes to Life show seeks to explore the potential of integrative medicine, and my guest this week is someone with a deep passion for that exploration who's returning to the show to talk about the complex issue of testing, an area that has exploded with options in recent years. I'm talking to functional medicine practitioner Mark Bennett over the internet at his home in Berkshire. Mark, really good to have you back on the Yes to Life show again.
Hello, Robin. I'm delighted to be back here. Thank you for asking me to get involved.
Great. So in today's show, I want to do a deep dive into testing. So it seems to me that over the last decade, testing's moved to take up a really central role in nutritional therapy, and that the primary accelerator for this movement was the rise of functional medicine, a formalised approach to health and well-being that's is actually about 25 or 30 years old, I think. But it's really began to come up the ranks in the last decade. Firstly, would you agree with that view? And secondly, as someone who's actually trained in functional medicine yourself, perhaps you'd give us a little introduction to the ways that functional medicine approaches optimizing someone's health.
Absolutely, Robin. Yes, no, functional medicine or the functional model of health is absolutely becoming more mainstream as a view on how we can resolve chronic or help individuals with any form of chronic disease. And of course, functional medicine or the functional model of health is entirely based on the sort of the other way of looking at well-being. You know, this isn't about treating symptoms, which of course is the domain of effectively what modern medicine is doing at this point in time. This is about, well, why does something happen in the first place? So if one thinks about the body as a sort of connection of multiple sophisticated interconnected, and the word interconnected is really important here, systems, you know, that all rely on each other and nothing in the body exists in isolation. And the concept here is that if you do develop an illness or a chronic condition, then it is actually based on your environmental inputs. And those inputs, you know, include things like what you eat, how you drink, what you think, how you move, your toxic load, your viral load, your bacterial load, your stress load. I mean, all these things that make our lives what it is have a phenomenal impact on our biochemistry. Mm. And over a period of time, these things can have obviously a considerable impact on how we function and ultimately push us, a lot of us, into conditions where we have chronic symptoms or, for example, even cancer. So when you use the functional model, what you're trying to do is evaluate how these different inputs have contributed to the condition that ultimately the client's presenting with. And what we try to do is then use tools to actually resolve those, the impact of those particular inputs. And so by assessing things that are called triggers, which initiate a problem, or mediators, things that perpetuate a particular problem, you're in a much better position to start to resolve chronic disease. Doesn't matter what disease you're talking about, whether it's cancer or dementia, it doesn't matter. You can start to actually have a positive impact on the outcome for that particular client. Mm-hmm. The other thing, Robin, to mention here is, you know, it's about individual biochemistry. What makes you you is unique to you. You know, it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. It really is not. And, you know, we talk about genetics. And I think we're going to talk about genetics today in terms of testing. But, you know, genetics load the gun and environment pulls the trigger. Just because you have a genetic predisposition to something does not mean that you will necessarily develop it. So it is a very different lens on well-being.
Mm. Well, look, I think you'll be heartened to hear. I was reading a report which has just come out, hot off the press from the government, which is about reducing over-prescription. And some of the things that are written in there, it could have come from the mouth of a functional medicine practitioner. I mean, it's quite surprising what is being said. There are practitioners complaining This is within the NHS, about treating symptoms and not really getting to the root causes and this type of thing, and talking about the need for personalisation. So it's pretty exciting, really, the effect that this completely different approach, if you like, to well-being is beginning to have on our overall national systems.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely saw that study, and it's great to see that, you know, that it's actually been recognised as, you know, being overprescription is an issue. Mm. And absolutely, then, and quite a large percentage of people being admitted to hospital is actually being admitted because of prescription medications. Right. I mean, it's ridiculous when you start to look at that from the point of view of load on the system, you know, which is actually just a home goal at the end of the day. It's madness.
Yeah.
Of course, looking at the root cause is the way forward. I mean, you know, I keep using this silly analogy. If you have a nail in your foot, you can take a painkiller or you can take the nail out. And of course, I know it's a very flippant, silly analogy, but it really gets the point across that, you know, just taking a painkiller, of course, there's a time and place to take pain medication. Of course there is. I mean, you know, obviously that needs to be done in certain situations. But a lot of the time, the root cause of the problem is just not being identified. And, you know, we cannot go on with this system of just treating everybody with drugs. It's just totally unsustainable. Mm. And we will go bankrupt over it. We are going bankrupt over it. And we've got to start looking at this from the other perspective, which is exactly what this is about. So at the end of the day, it's just asking why, you know, and this is when I sit down with clients and we start to look at what's driving, you know, why they're feeling the way they are, or whether they, or if I'm working with a cancer patient on a complementary basis, you know, has anybody asked you the question or talked to you about why you developed this cancer in the first place? And the answer is always no, you know, unless it's obvious, like, for example, smoking or something like that. Right. But, you know, it never ceases to amaze me how that question is very rarely, or that point is very rarely discussed.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very interesting because the one thing we note is that the raft of tools that are available to find out what's going on within functional medicine is large and it's growing all the time. And it does go way beyond what's available within standard healthcare, doesn't it?
Totally, absolutely it does. But what I would love to see, and quite frankly, it would save fortunes if we did this. I mean, okay, the tools that we use are classified as being expensive, but if they were used properly and widely, we would save a fortune. Mm. So it's ironic, isn't it, that,
yes,
you know, by spending some money, that you would ultimately save money, because that's exactly what happens. You know, if you get people well and you can maintain that wellness, that health, then obviously there's less burden on the system. So, you know, health is a really interesting, it's a really interesting topic, actually, when one starts to look at sort of, you know, what is health, because we seem to have a very skewed perspective on health. You know, it's always about, you know, he or she was as fit as a fiddle, but they dropped down dead of a heart attack. Well, clearly, yes, they weren't as fit as a fiddle, because
exactly,
they wouldn't have dropped down dead of a heart attack. You know, so it's like this concept that health, you know, is somebody who's got a six pack and or looks sort of thin, maybe not overweight, or, you know, we have these sort of very broad views on what health equates to. But it's not just the absence of disease. You know, this is actually about a state of complete physical, mental and social well-being. I mean, the World Health Organization itself has actually defined health as being that. Mm. So, and there are other ways of looking at this as well. It's like, you know, health is the least amount of energy required to maintain balance. I love that. You know, so metabolically, you don't have to paddle as fast or as hard to actually maintain balance. So it's a very different way of looking at it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it so often gets missed that what a win-win good health is, both for the public purse and for the public. The public are actually well and enjoy good health. And there is a genuine saving, as you point out, in not having to try to continually fix people who are unhealthy. And, you know, this concept of investing for the future is not really something that goes down well when the budget is already huge. But, you know, without that, it's difficult to see how we can make a significant step forward.
Totally. I mean, the return on investment would be substantial, massive. And it's just changing the mindset, you know, changing the mindset of the system. But, I mean, how we do that is the big issue. you know, it's a slow burn, isn't it? This is going to take time. And it is happening. Things are happening. There is change afoot.
Yes.
You know, I'm starting to see much more interest from certain, you know, conventionally medically trained individuals about the stuff that people like myself do, you know, rather than actually shooting us down in flames as being quacks and witch doctors, actually starting to say, well, actually, how are you managing to help this particular client and this particular issue? You know, it's actually, well, maybe there are other things that we can do. And of course there are. We could genuinely have a pandemic of well-being if we just did some really simple things. I mean, honestly, Robin, I really, really mean that. I mean, you know, as a generic basis, just looking at the sort of nutritional guidelines, if we just, for example, cut out heating our food in seed oils, vegetable oils, you know, actually frying our foods in these oils, which we've all been doing because we've been told to sort of do that to reduce cardiovascular risk, we would, you know, genuinely, that would have a disproportionate impact on just the metabolic function of the nation. Or the world, anybody who took this on board. So there's some very simple, very low-hanging fruit, so to speak, that we could do that would actually have a very, very significant impact on us over a decades of time.
Okay, well, there we are. That's functional medicine. Now I want to dive into the testing, as I mentioned. So this ever-expanding raft of tests that functional medicine adopted and relies on to benchmark the condition and the progress of a client's health, they come under the heading, rightly enough, of functional tests. And reliance on these has become absolutely normal in nutritional practice now. So that's outside of functional medicine. I'd say that, you know, nearly all nutritionists think in the same way. So this is the change from, like, try this, it might help, to actually finding out exactly if there's a deficiency that needs to be made up or whatever. So the new kid on the block in terms of testing, though, is genetic testing. It's quite different animal, and it provides a fundamentally different sort of information to functional testing. So I think the difference isn't something that's quite obvious to everybody. So could you just make clear the difference between functional testing and genetic testing?
Absolutely, Robin. So with functional testing, one is looking at a whole raft of different analytes. And of course, the tests are typically when I recommend functional tests in the conventional sense to my client base, we're doing stuff that is not done as standard on the NHS. There's no point us repeating or trying to do something that's already offered under that particular system or service.
Right.
But this is also not just about the test, it's also about the lens that is applied to that test. So, you know, it's really interesting when you look at just the humble full blood count, for example, you know, which is run in surgeries all over the country. Normal is not optimal. And, you know, we have reference ranges. These are things that, you know, this is the expected range for a particular analyte, you know, whether it's, you know, TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, or ferritin, whatever it is. And, you know, you've got the range goes from a low number to a high number. And those ranges are enormous, typically. I mean, really big. And, you know, normal, you know, how often do you hear, you know, well, the doctor says my results are normal. Well, you know, how often do I say, and I say it a lot, well, normal is not what we want. You know, it's normal to be depressed. It's normal to have IBS. Do you want normal? You know, we want optimal. And optimal, you know, normal is not optimal. And optimal is a very, very tight range in the middle of those reference ranges. So when you look at this functionally, I would argue that, you know, applying the functional principles is saying, well, okay, just squeezing in on the bottom end of the reference range for ferritin, or being just before you get kicked off the top end of the reference range for ferritin, is not good enough. You know, you want to be closer into the optimal range. So that's really the sort of conventional functional tests. And, you know, we can talk more about the types of tests, and I think we're going to talk about that at some point further down this conversation, about the sort of tests we look at providing clients with outside the sort of the conventional tests of the NHS run. But when you look at genetic testing, you know, this is, let's get one thing absolutely clear up front. I'm not using genetic tests to find mutations, not mutations in the sense of, you know, if you've got this gene, you're going to develop this type of condition or disease. That's not what we do. What we do is we look for things called polymorphisms. These are single nucleotide polymorphisms, or called SNPs. And what that means in English is that the bases that make up DNA, and you've basically got four bases, and you've got, you know, adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. These are the four bases that make up DNA. And a SNP is where one of these bases is replaced with another base. So there are certain things that can happen, okay, within the genetic testing. So if, for example, you've got, and I'm sorry if this is getting complex, but just as an example, you've got something called MTHFR, which is this methylation gene that a lot of people have heard about, methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, is a gene that basically pushes folate towards the remethylation of homocysteine, which is a marker that if it gets out of control is a problem from the point of view of health and indeed cancer. Well, you've got the wild type of this gene, which is basically got two C's, it's CC, and what can happen is CC can be substituted, so C can be substituted for a T. So C is cytosine and T is thymine. So when you get a substitution going on, what that means is that that enzyme, that particular enzyme that takes folate and pushes it towards remethylating homocysteine is not working as efficiently as it would be in a wild-type CC situation. So what that means is if you can find out that information through a genetic test, and this is available now, you know, relatively inexpensively, you then know that that client is actually on the back foot with that particular gene that provides that particular function, and therefore you might want to consider making sure that the nutrient status is absolutely optimized in order to ensure that that is doing the job as best it can, even though it's suboptimal, if that makes sense.
Mm.
So this is not about, you know, getting, for example, magnesium into an optimal range, you know, i.e. not low on the function, on the normal range, on the reference range, or too high. It's actually about it's about very definitive outcomes from the test, the genetic test. And you can have these substitutions that I've just given an explanation or an example of. And you can also have deletions. So you can have deletions on genetic profiles to do with making certain genes. For example, glutathione, S-transferase, can actually have a deletion. And that means that you are less likely, or you will not produce a particular type of enzyme that is required for phase two detoxification. And if you don't have that ability to produce that particular enzyme, that, of course, puts you on the back foot for detoxification. So you've got to be more aware of looking after the detoxification process. So, you know, things like smoking and drinking too much with that type of genetic profile is obviously a risk, a much greater risk than if you did have that particular ability to produce that particular enzyme. So it is a completely different way of looking at these things, but you can't cure SNPs, polymorphisms. You can't cure them. You can't, like, change them. They are what they are. That's what, you know, that's what you're dealt with. And in the future, they will no doubt be able to engineer and change genetic variations. But at this point in time, your genes are your genes. So what you do is you use that information to work out where you need to put the attention when it comes to helping the client to regain control.
Right. Okay, so a sort of summary of that might be to say that whereas the functional tests are giving a sort of a snapshot of where you're at actually in terms of your nutrient status, etc., the genetic test is kind of giving you a background into the environment in which that's all going on, your basic set of genes you were issued with, and how well they will deal with particular circumstances. Is that a reasonable way to put it?
That's a beautiful way of putting it. Absolutely brilliant. And of course, you know, when I'm working with clients, we use the genetic test to allow us, you know, we really focus on a set number of genes. We don't test everything because that's ridiculous. You just have information overload.
Right.
What you're looking to do is what are the key areas of biochemistry that are affected through particular SNPs. And if, for example, you do have a reduction in methylation capability as per the example I gave, then if you then in the blood work actually find out that homocysteine is raised, you know you've got a problem. That's where the rubber hits the tarmac. That's where the genes literally express themselves, and you actually have a real marker in the blood And that shows that you've got an issue there that you've got to work harder on. Mm. So, yes, it's the backdrop.
Right. And one other thing I wanted to go back to is you used the word wild every now and then and just threw it in. Can you just explain what you mean by that?
Wild type is just what you would expect to see in the standard population. So wild is viewed as just being the sort of the normal.
Okay, that's fine. So that would be that no SNPs.
Absolutely, no SNPs.
Right. Okay, that's great. Thank you very much for all that. I guess because functional testing has been around that much longer, more people are familiar with it, or at least have some experience or knowledge of it. And as you pointed out, functional tests are actually what they're doing in conventional medicine, just a smaller range of them. I wonder if you just give us a bit of a tour now around the world of functional tests. What's out there? What do you absolutely rely on and use regularly? And what do you think is essential under certain circumstances?
Okay. There's a lot to... lot to answer there, Robin, but essentially there are hundreds and hundreds of functional tests that are available out there from a huge array of labs all over the world. Mm. And practitioners will become comfortable with using a certain suite of tests, like such as I do, on a large, a large proportion of their clients. And we can discuss affordability and whether it's appropriate in a minute. But in terms of, it's not suitable for everybody to do the tests. And often you can achieve great returns by just making sensible clinical judgments about what you think is going on based on symptomatology. That absolutely is also doable.
Okay.
However, when one is working with more complex chronic conditions, and of course cancer falls into that category, I don't like to make guesses. I'd much rather be precise. If the client can justify the cost, then I would much rather be not shooting in the dark, but actually saying, well, okay, these are the areas that we really need to focus on because we have real data that shows that these areas need attention. Mm. And that is going to be, that makes a lot more sense than just saying, well, this may be an issue or not an issue. So in terms of the types of tests that I would typically use, I use stool tests, comprehensive stool tests a lot. I use in-depth biochemistry and nutrient status blood testing. That is, absolutely fundamental. The stool test and the sort of blood chemistry nutrient profile, I would say, is something that I would run on virtually everybody if possible, because gut health is the engine room of our biochemistry. We know that as well through the science that I read on a regular basis and the science that's out there. It's incredible how important gut health is, and we know that is the correlation between gut, the microflora, and all cancers is absolutely there's science paper after science paper showing the link between that, and also how well you even respond to chemotherapy treatments is also based on your microflora. So to be honest, that's really, really important part of the client picture, so to speak. And then looking at the biochemistry, understanding nutrient profile, how do you know if somebody's, for example, lacking in selenium, or what's their copper status, or iron or magnesium, or these things are really important. But not just looking at nutrient status, but also trying to look at their liver function, their kidney function, their thyroid function, the electrolyte status, their blood sugar management, fasted insulin. Why do we not measure fasted insulin on the NHS as standard? We just don't do it. But fasted insulin is really important from the point of view of blood sugar management. It's key. Inappropriate blood sugar management drives most dysfunction. And a lot of people, I'm not talking about everybody being diabetic or pre-diabetic, but lots of people are actually really not managing their blood sugars well at all. And that is really a big issue. So, using those type of tests, and then I start to use things like leaky gut tests. So we start to look at zonulin levels, histamine levels, and leakiness, how the immune system responds to things called lipopolysaccharides, which gives us an indication of how leaky the gut is, which is really fundamental. So if you've got a stool test, and these tests, by the way, interrelate with each other. So for example, if you've got a leaky gut, or you've got elevated histamine levels, well, where's the histamine coming from? Fasted. Well, it's probably coming from the gut. So you, then you look at the stool test to say, well, okay, which bacterial species are out of balance and which ones are driving the elevated histamine? You know, so these things have got to overlay on top of each other, and you, they're not like little silos. It's the same principle as functional medicine or the functional approach. Everything is connected. So if you use a suite of tests, they literally got to dovetail into each other, and you can say, right, this test result validates that test result, and you can start to build up a comprehensive picture. It's like putting a jigsaw puzzle together of the client.
Right.
And, okay, the genetics suggest this. This suggests that, you know, what are we going to do now? Where does the rubber hit the tarmac? How do we then turn that information into a lifestyle plan that involves diet, you know, diet, what food groups are you going to eat? Which foods are you going to avoid? What about your stress levels? You know, are you going to do deep breathing, yoga, meditation? What about infrared saunas? You know, and it just builds this ability using the data to drive the intervention in a scientific, methodical, strategic way.
Mm-hmm. So what I was asking about, you know, some tests being essential in some circumstances within the realms of cancer, is that something you would say? I mean, for example, with some types of cancer, would you always run hormone tests, for example?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're looking at individuals who, for example, I've got hormonally sensitive cancers, for breast cancer, for example, and it is, you know, hormonally sensitive type, then yes, it's like, again, it's the question, why? Why did they develop that issue in the first place? So actually running a dried urine strip test that actually looks at the balance of those hormones, okay, so estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, but also how estrogens are detoxified. And this is the important point. It's like, you know, how is E1 literally pushed out of the body? You know, how is it eliminated from the body? And, you know, what is the proportion between E2, E4 and E16 effectively, estrogen 16. So this is about a balance, you know, and you want lots of two, but you want sort of minimal amounts of 4 and 16. And if you've got a disproportionate output, which you can get this pie chart from this strip test, this dried urine strip test, then you've got a problem. And that may be one of the reasons why you push yourself towards that condition in the first place. But you can adjust that pie chart based on the things you do through diet and lifestyle. So absolutely. But of course, the problem we have, of course, is that when I'm working with cancer patients, Robin, is that 9 times out of 10, they're already going through treatment. They're already going through hormone treatment. You know, so if they're taking letrozole to suppress the estrogens, then of course you can't do this stuff because everything's already being impacted. So it is, you know, sometimes, and with cancer clients, it's often the case that you've got to make assumptions because of the treatments that they're going through, which impact the ability to do the test. So it isn't a black and white situation. You know, you do the test when you can do them in order to drive that really useful information. But going back to, I would, you know, no matter what the client is going through, I would also be looking at blood chemistry work. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is to understand nutrient status, and to understand inflammation, and to also have a benchmark against which you can monitor biochemical progress. And I think, you know, if you measure something, you can manage it. It's not about, you know, I'm feeling better today. You know, it's about, okay, well, what do your markers actually tell us that are going on? So 6 months ago, your markers here in this particular section were out. How are they faring now? And this is what's happening with clients. They're retesting every 6 months in order to then monitor their biochemical progress. Okay. And if something's not right and not going in the right direction, then we've got to ask the question, why? Mm. So these are very, very powerful tools, you know, very powerful tools used in the right way because they measure biochemical progress. Mm. And at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is push people towards biochemical stability and the ability and nutrient stability in terms of having the nutrients that the body needs in order to do everything it needs to do as well as possible.
Yeah, well, enormously important what you're saying there because, yeah, one of the features of you know, very complex protocols for cancer, for example, and you know, typically with your marginal gains principle, people are doing lots of things that make a bit of a difference, And they're very complicated. And yeah, the most important thing you need to know is, well, is it working? Because you can waste an awful lot of time thinking you're doing all right and then suddenly finding out you're not. So that's practically is very important. But also, I think you can't underestimate how psychologically it's very important that you have a degree of certainty about what you're achieving with your protocol.
Absolutely, because you know, because we're not funded by the NHS, and what I do is not funded by the NHS. I mean, people are investing considerable sums of money, of their own money and time and energy, into doing these things, and of course they want to measure their returns. They want to know that they're going in the right direction. And as a practitioner, I want to measure that. I want to make sure, because it's really important. It's really important for future clients to know that if we do X with an individual with Y, then, you know, and we get these outcomes, then the chances are that's going to be beneficial for future people who've got those type of issues. So this is actually building up a database of how one interacts with clients with certain conditions in order to help them achieve their end goals. So totally, it's really important, because it just validates the approach. But of course, there is no point measuring things that you can't then, you know, what's the point of running a test if you then think to yourself, well, what are you going to do with that outcome? Mm-hmm. That's totally pointless. You know, what you want to do is run tests where you can say, right, okay, we have got nutrient issues here, deficiency issues here, or suboptimal status here. This is what we're going to do dietarily, or use targeted supplementation to rebalance those imbalances. You know, or the gut, for example, is dysbiotic. It's got imbalances in bacteria, which is compromising absorption. So we've got to resolve those issues first before we start pouring, you know, supplementation down, which is not necessarily going to deliver the benefits it should do. It's about joined up thinking. It's about looking at everything, how it interrelates with each other. And that's the key point here, so that you maximize the outcome for the client. Mm.
Quite a juggling act, eh? All these variables. Okay, that's what you're fascinated with, though. I understand.
No, totally. I mean, I'm probably, yeah, it's probably a fixation. It's probably an obsession, actually. I'm obsessed with, you know, human biochemistry. I'm just fascinated by the whole thing. And of course, you know, you can't test everything. It's not possible to test everything. You wouldn't want to test everything, because it's not possible to get your head around all the data. But what matters is the big issues. You know, methylation, we know through the science that if you're under methylating and your homocysteine levels are raised, you have a much greater chance of developing certain very significant chronic diseases. So if we can get the methylation working better, you are instantly putting that client into a better position.
Right. Okay, very good. Well, that's why people come to an expert like you, to get those priorities right and not just to try anything that sounds good. Okay, can we move on now and take a look at genetic testing? As I mentioned, these tests are relatively new to the world of nutritional medicine. You've been trained in this field. So my first question is, how much do you rely on genetic tests, and how often will you recommend them to clients?
That's a good question. Yes, I'm a nutrigenetic counsellor for all my sins. And essentially what that means, you know, I understand, I've been trained in the science of how nutrients can impact our genes. And it is incredible what can be done. But when it comes to whether one runs a genetic test or not, I don't do it. I don't do it all the time, every time with all clients, because as I said, you can't actually change the genes of a client. You can't heal a SNP. You know, you can't, it is a SNP is a SNP. You know, once it's there, it's there. Right. We tend to use it when clients are very unwell, you know, with a significant chronic condition, such as cancer. Yes, I would say as a backdrop, you know, going back to what we were discussing early on, I think it's absolutely essential. And also, the genetic tests are the cheapest tests to run. You know, they are the low value item in the list of tests. So like, well, why wouldn't you do that? Yeah. So understanding how or where you've got to put the attention is I think incredibly useful, because of, you know, because the genes say, well, do you not, we don't need to worry about lipids. You know, lipids, your lipid profile from a genetic perspective is like a is really, you know, it's insignificant from the point of view of any problems that could occur there. But actually your detoxification is really compromised because you've got these genetic deletions going on. And that is really going to put you on the back foot when it comes to detoxification. And so understanding that, I think, is really important. And of course, you can run tests, genetic tests through 23andMe or, you know, other companies. Lots of companies are offering gene testing, and it is very affordable indeed. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's good. And it's sort of telling you what the raw material you're working with is in terms of, why things might have gone wrong in the first place, where to put your attention, all that kind of thing, I'm imagining.
Totally. I mean, that is exactly the point. It's about, you know, well, okay, if you've got a genetic polymorphism that says you don't convert as much beta-carotene actually into retinol, the active form of vitamin A, then clearly you need to be taking in more retinol, you know, in its actual preformed state, as opposed to eating carrots. So you'd have more animal-based retinol in your diet than just relying on eating lots of beta-carotene in carrots, for example. Mm. You know, that's just a very simple concept, but it just gets a point across that, you know, exactly, you know, if you've got an issue, for example, and let's take another example. Let's say you are a slow metabolizer of caffeine. You know, that's a really interesting one. It's like, well, you know, I know from my own genes that I'm a hyper metabolizer of caffeine. So I can have a double espresso at 11 o'clock at night and go to sleep. Now, but it's not just caffeine. It's because caffeine is processed through certain pathways in the liver that also are used for the body to get rid of drugs. So, you know, I will kick out drugs from my body much faster than somebody who is a slow metabolizer of caffeine. So actually this comes down to, it is unique to you. So if you're taking painkillers, for example, then, you know, painkillers are going to be kicked out of my body a lot quicker than somebody else who's got a different genetic profile. So that is very relevant to how much of a medication one is taking, a pharmaceutical one is taking, and how often one takes it. So that's just another example of, you know, that type of profile. And also drinking coffee after midday for somebody who's metabolizing caffeine slowly is probably not a good idea.
Right, right, as we know. Okay, so I want to come back and talk a bit more about prioritizing. You already alluded to some of the things that you have to juggle around when you're trying to decide what tests to go for, what to recommend. And first of all, there's an almost unlimited number of them out there. Secondly, they've got different costs, and some of them are quite high, but also some of them could be seen as absolutely essential, really important, even though they might be expensive. So can I just ask you a little bit about navigating these issues successfully, which I'm guessing a lot of it has to be done with the actual client?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, when you're talking to a client, you have no idea how far they want to push this particular subject. You know, so, you know, I never assume anything. I just give the client the options as to this is what. I mean, when I look at any client interaction, Robin, the way I look at this is, what would I do in their shoes knowing what I know? That's how I have to treat every client interaction. So it's not for me to suggest somebody doesn't do something or does do something. You know, it's like, well, here are the options. These are the things that I genuinely feel, if you can justify doing them, I would suggest you do them, because actually we can get really useful data which will help us construct and craft the most appropriate intervention for you. Okay. So that's where I start. But of course, I understand money doesn't grow on trees, and not everybody has unlimited resources in order to be able to finance these tests. So then what we do is we prioritize them. So I would say, look, a blood chemistry profile, understanding nutrient status, inflammatory markers, and how all your main systems are working is really, really, really key. That's like, you know, really important. A stool test is really, really important. You know, we then move into the realms of things like histamine, leaky gut. We then start to talk about food sensitivity testing, which is a minefield. I mean, honestly, right. You know, it's we could run a whole 45-minute discussion on just food sensitivity testing. Yeah. I mean, it's a minefield, but it's so useful if you can do it if you can do it. And remember, of course, a lot of cancer clients obviously are on chemotherapy, so you can't do this stuff. You know, obviously you can't, because their immune systems are suppressed. So it's not even an option with the vast majority of cancer clients because of the chemotherapy. But if you can do it, it is very, very useful indeed, because, you know, understanding how one's immune system is responding to certain food proteins that one's eating in the diet, okay, is really key from the point of view of reducing inflammation, systemic inflammation. Right. And if somebody's on the back foot, then the gut health typically drives, or your microflora typically dictates how your immune system will react. So you lose oral tolerance towards vast amounts of food proteins, which then drives, you know, inflammation within the body. And there's also a connection between the type of immune response and, for example, histamine. So IgE, the sort of allergy immune responses that are detected specifically on certain tests, directly fuel histamine release. And histamine is correlated with heightened inflammation and absolutely is correlated with chronic dysfunction and also cancer. So, you know, you can really see the importance of understanding how the client is responding or reacting immunologically to certain food proteins within their diet. Now, not everybody can do that. Not, they can't afford it necessarily, and they may not also be able to do it because their immune system is being suppressed. But it's really giving them the option within the context of what they can do from the point of view of the meds they're taking, and it's for them to decide what to do. However, what I would say is that if the client can't justify these costs, and obviously a number of clients can't, then not all is lost, because actually you can take the humble full blood count, you know, the standard blood test that's run by GPs across the country or in hospitals, you know, just the standard, you know, let's look at hematology, let's look at your white blood cell, your neutrophils, your lymphocytes, all that stuff, which is just standard stuff. It's really cheap to run. It's easily accessible. And if you apply a functional lens, you know, the optimal lens that we talked about earlier,
yeah,
to that data, you can honestly work out so much information from that, just from that humble test. And it is really, really staggering how much information you can glean from those tests, even when they're classified as normal. You know, normal is not optimal. So, you know, you'll be, you know, different markers within the red blood cell part of the test can be very, very revealing. You know, if you've got RDW is raised, then it's possible that you've got low folate or B12 going on. But then looking at just neutrophil to lymphocyte ratios or lymphocyte to monocyte ratios, which can be used to actually track progress with cancer clients in particular. So these ratios really do tell you over a period of time whether you're winning or losing, you know, with this type of condition. A humble platelet, calcium levels, you know, ferritin, you know, I mean, if your ferritin levels are raised too high, you know, above optimal, that's trouble. You know, that's trouble. You don't want to have high iron stores in the body. Well, you know, it sort of gives you an indication that iron metabolism is compromised, and iron, of course, is, you know, fuels pathogens, it fuels chronic conditions. You need iron. Iron is essential for human physiology, but you do not want too much iron.
Right.
What about CRP markers, you know, which measure systemic inflammation, or hsCRP, highly sensitive CRP? These are really useful bog standard analytes that can be supplied by your doctor, you know, and actually putting that together, a talented practitioner can really start to see between, or read between the lines as to what might be going on.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Look, we're getting quite short on time. I'm just interested, it sounds to me as though maybe quite often you don't end up with nearly as many tests as you'd like. But then you have a different kind of challenge, which is getting the most out of what you've got. Are you often frustrated working in a sort of a budgetary environment, which is not, you know, what you'd really like? Do you feel like you're able to offer less to the patient as a result?
It's a very good question. I'm not sure the word, I don't think I feel frustrated. I think I'm just... I'm disappointed that we are not able to do the things that I would love to be able to do in order to really refine the approach so that the client gets the best result possible.
Right.
So it is frustrating, but I've gone beyond being frustrated on this. I'm just disappointed. I'm disappointed that the system doesn't acknowledge this approach, which is not witchcraft, Robin. This is not, I'm not a wizard. I've been called lots of things, but honestly, this is science. I spend my life reading science and applying the principles of biochemistry and understanding the interrelationships between things that are not just balanced. And I just wish that this stuff was embraced, because as I said right at the beginning of this conversation, we would actually save a fortune by using this approach. This would actually save money, even though it costs a bit more maybe up front. It would actually save money well down the line, no question about it.
All right. Well, look, on the matter of costs, I'm pleased to see that on your website you're transparent about the fact that any diagnostic testing and supplementation recommendations will be provided to you at cost. When you hear what goes on in the USA with people making massive kickbacks for prescribing chemo, you wonder how patients can trust any treatment recommendations. So that's really important. We're going to skip straight over chemosensitivity testing, which I understand is not something you've been engaged with, but it does exist, and it's another whole area of testing that needs to be taken into consideration as well. I just want to finish off on underlining, really, something you mentioned earlier on, which is about making sure that you do tests which produce a result you can actually do something with. I've actually come across this quite often, people actually having a test which tells them that this particular treatment would be really beneficial for them, but then afterwards find out that nobody will give it to them. So complete waste of money. So do you want to say something about that just to finish off?
Well, absolutely. I mean, obviously, you do not want to run a test, find out a set of results, and then not be able to do something with that data and actually do something about those results. So, I would not, I mean, it's slightly different in my world. We would not recommend tests. I certainly would not recommend a test or a client that you do not have the ability to impact the results, so that you can obviously monitor their progress over a period of time. That's obviously it's unethical. I just don't think it's the right thing. It's just not the right thing to be doing. So, totally. I mean, pulling back on your last point also about the cost of these tests, yes, absolutely. I mean, trust between my client and myself is absolutely paramount to them getting the most out of what we recommend to them. So the minute we have that dilution of trust or the erosion of trust because they think I'm recommending something in order to make a margin on it, whether that's a test or a supplement, instantly you've got problems, because then if the trust dissolves, the client is just not going to believe anymore in what you're suggesting, and therefore that is a fundamental issue from the point of view of outcomes. So, yes, unfortunately we've got to charge for our time, and I've got to make a living, of course I do, but this is about saying, well, I charge for my time, but I will not make anything on product. Product that I recommend to you. So it is really important that the client understands that, and they understand the last point you just raised, which is if we're testing for something and something's not right, what can we do about it? And I just wouldn't recommend a test to anybody that I didn't believe we had some element of control over.
Well, that's an illustration of the way in which having an expert on hand, paying for an expert, could actually save you money doing useless tests. So, all right, we're going to have to end it there, Mark. Tons more to talk about, of course, but it's really interesting, and thanks. You did a great job explaining all this mass of tests that are out there. It's a bit of a minefield for people to find their way through, and I'm sure that's been very helpful to people in getting the basics sorted out.
Yeah, absolutely, Robin. A real pleasure. And thank you for asking me on. And I'm delighted to have hopefully added some value to that conversation.
Great. Thank you very much, Mark.
Pleasure, Robin.
Cheers. All the best. Bye-bye. Well, I did mention there had been an explosion of options in testing recently. It's an amazing resource for people with cancer, but also a place to get rather lost without some expert guidance. So I hope today's show was useful in laying out some of the territory for you. A reminder that YesToLife has an online forum coming up on Saturday, 23rd of October. It's a groundbreaking event called Bridging the Gap, and it's setting out to explore how we can gain acceptance by oncology professionals of a whole range of safe integrative interventions. The event's being hosted in partnership with Pennybron UK and will feature some brilliant speakers, including Dr. Catherine Zollman, Medical Director of Pennybron, Dr. Nina Fuller-Chavelle, who's featured on the show many times, and Dr. Penny Kekayoglu, Senior NHS Oncologist, who jointly hosts the Cancer Talk podcast series with me. To find out more and to book your place at a very accessible price, go to yestolife.org.uk and click the large Show Details button on the banner at the top of the homepage. Thanks for listening to the show today. I'll be back next week with another, so I hope you'll join me again for the next YesToLife show on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.